Fred Film Radio, Venice Film Festival, Italy.
Hello, 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 everyone. My name is Philippe Reinhardt, and I have the pleasure to introduce this session of Europe in Focus. In a few minutes, we will talk about an immaterial notion that has become essential for our sector. I mean intellectual properties. But before we open the discussion, I must remind you that this roundtable was initiated by the European Commission, and that we have the chance to have with us today a member of its parliament. As she is really invested in defending our interests, she will introduce the subject of the day, and so I'm asking you a warm welcome to Miss Laurence Farin.
Bonjour à tous. Now I'm going to speak in English because it's our international language, even if I prefer diversity, but that's it. So, dear all, thank you very much for inviting me to give you a few words of introduction on intellectual property in the transmedia world. I'm very pleased to be in the Mostra again, because the last time I had the opportunity to come in the Venice Film Festival, it was in September 2020, 3 years ago, for a rather special edition, because we were just going out of the COVID crisis. It was the first festival, cultural festival, that was reopening. Cinemas were empty, film shoots were at standstill, and we had no idea how long this situation would last. It was also the time when the European Parliament voted on a resolution to dedicate at least 2% of the recovery plan to Europe's cultural and creative industries after approving an historical budgetary effort to support our continent. And that was made. We had this 2%. It was not in the legislative file, but we checked every day with the commissioner. It was Maria Gabriel. She left now, but that it was done, and we reached this point to raise the importance of culture at the European level, and that was quite a success for us. And I had many colleagues that was with me in this fight. So today I'm particularly delighted to be able to speak to you at a festival that has regained its color, its films, and of course its participants. Intellectual property is a subject that is not always easy to grasp for the European public. You immediately get the impression that it's a complete legal matter governed by complicated legal texts, and that you need to have pursued a career in copyright law to understand anything about it. And if you mix that with European politics and parliamentary legal processes, it generally puts people off. Nevertheless, IP is all around us and deeply rooted in our lives, particularly when it comes to culture. The characters, words, illustrations, music and games are what make up our culture and convey our European values. Against a backdrop of international competition, it's crucial for players in the European Union to be able to master the issues surrounding intellectual property. The first step is to measure the value of IP. It's not just a legal detail, it's really an economic issue. In the video game industry, for example, when we see that Microsoft is prepared to put up to $69 billion on the table to acquire Activision Blizzard and the Call of Duty license, we understand the colossal stakes involved in owning intellectual property. It also involves IP. Retaining IP, sorry. At the European Parliament, we are particularly active on the issue of buyout contracts. The transfer of all right to broadcaster when it's not the interest of the creator. We must, of course, defend contractual freedom, but we must also ensure that the climate in which negotiations take place enables rights holders to retain their IP. Finally, and I think it is the main topic of the day, demonstrating the value of transmedia exploitation of intellectual property. Today's panelists know better than I do that we are in the era of transsectorial licensing. And we can see this today with the success of licenses such as The Witcher, which has gone from book to video games to audiovisual, for example. Our continent knows how to tell and create rich, universal stories that showcase our diversity and our values, often as part of co-production. It's the role of the European Union to raise awareness of transmedia exploitation, to help creators with their intellectual property strategy, and to bring together talent and know-how across our continent. Our Europe Creative Media Programme makes this kind of scheme possible. But once again, we need a budget. We were talking about it. We need a budget to match the cultural challenges facing Europe. And I think everyone here will agree with me. In conclusion, one last word about this current political context in terms of IP. Recently, it was on the subject of artificial intelligence that IP came back on the agenda. As you are no doubt aware, the institutions are currently working on the AI Act, which should make the European Union the first continent to have a robust framework for determining the rules to be followed by AI systems deployed on our continents. This text will be only the beginning, as the text created by generative AI such as ChatGPT, DALL-E or Midjourney are so high. And I hope that we will soon be working hand in hand with our European creators on a framework to define the use of European intellectual property in these systems. We need to be able to take advantage on this change while ensuring our creations are protected and fairly rewarded. On this word, I wish you a very fruitful discussion on this fascinating topic. I thank you very much again for this invitation. I was proud to represent the European Parliament today. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Laurence. It was a pleasure to listen to you, and I think in the next months we have to vote thinking about what you said. And now, let's debate. May I ask to the panelists to join? Sven, David, Philippe, Theo, please. If you don't mind, I'm speaking to... Oh, stay with us, Theo. Italy is quite dangerous for the moment. So, as I said, if you don't mind, in order to go right to the point, I will introduce the participant to our panel during the first intervention. And so, to begin, I address David Duza of the company Dark Riviera. This is this guy in blue. David, you are both a director and a scenarist, writing for yourself, but also for others. Series, feature films, broadcast by TF1, Keshet, Viaplay, Apple TV, and so and so. And your works are seen all over the world, from Scandinavia when you grew up to China where you worked for a long time. As you noticed, I'm a man of a certain age.
No.
Yeah, let's be realistic. So I would tend to present you as a noter, as in the good old time. But you, you define yourself as an IP creator. So I really want to know the difference between those two notions and what does this semantic shift reveal?
Okay, hello everyone. Thank you very much for having me on this panel. Thank you to the European Union for organizing this and to support us. What is an IP creator? I would like to start by paraphrasing Iggy Pop when he said, they asked him, what do you think about culture? And he answered, culture. I hate that word. So I hate the word IP, to be honest, but it's a very useful word. And yes, I'm an IP creator. And what is the difference? So we created Dark Riviera with three other people. Beside myself, there is Emily Blézard, who's a creative producer, but also a writer in her own right. There is Sylvain Runeberg, who is a very prolific graphic novel artist, writer, sorry. He has done 120 books. And then we have Robert Bäckström, who is a Swedish video game producer. So I think maybe the best way to describe what is an IP creator is that I'm an author, but together with these people, I'm an IP creator. So I think the fundamental difference between writing in a classical sense is that any artist, any writer has a media that he or she prefers. So like TV series, books, video games, whatever. But it's almost impossible to think in all those formats as well. So we come together and we are authors and we create from scratch. Now, that doesn't mean that we create all the media at once. We usually concentrate on one or another. So let's say this project will exist first as a graphic novel and then it will become a video game or in any other. And then, so the person, the author in the group who has the most experience in that media takes the lead, while the others are there to feed the project and to imagine those stories imagine how that story will be then, how will it exist in TV series, for example, or in video games. So that's, I think, is IP creation is to work together with people and to, maybe better to explain is like world building, probably. Like we are building worlds in this way.
Thank you. Yes. Thank you. I would say thank you, Iggy, but I stay with David. At the Cannes Film Festival in 1963, the Palme d'Or was awarded to Luchino Visconti's masterpiece, Il Gattopardo, The Leopard, I think in English. This magnificent film was in fact the adaptation of the only book ever written by Giuseppe Tomasi di Lampedusa, published 5 years earlier by the Feltrinelli editions. And today we welcome a representative of this true Italian cultural institution, Mr. Theo Collier, rights director for the Feltrinelli group. Theo, I've just recalled that the management of intellectual property is a long tradition for your group. But does this management know a spectacular development in the recent years, maybe since you are there?
Well, hello everyone, and thank you very much for having me here. Gattopardo is one of the key properties of the Feltrinelli Publishing Group. We were the original publisher of that novel, and as such, we acquired all rights in all formats for any kind of adaptation, translation of the novel, and we also hold all rights to Dr. Zhivago by Boris Pasternak, which is another key modern classic of the Feltrinelli catalogue. I would say that we have certainly seen an increase in our licensing activity in the last 10 years, particularly in the realm of book to film, book to television, and in fact, Dr. Zhivago is currently being optioned for a new television series that's in development at the moment, and Il Gattopardo is in production as we speak for a new TV series, which will probably be broadcast in 2024. I would say, as an aggregator of rights in publishing properties, the key activity 20 or 30 years ago was licensing translation rights to other publishers. What has changed, I think, recently is the precisely the question of multi-format. And now we find ourselves doing, as I said, a lot of film and television licensing. But we're also moving into the world of podcasts, and book publishing itself is a multi-format activity in that you know, the traditional format was hardcover, then came paperbacks. Now there are e-books. Virtually all of our key frontlist titles are published these days simultaneously as audiobooks. And now it's perfectly possible to imagine a scenario whereby a podcast becomes a book, and then that product, that property is developed into a film. Or first comes the film, then comes the podcast, and finally comes the book, fan fiction spinning off from a TV series, etc.
So we are really living in the transmedia world?
Well, I'd like to say so, yes. I mean, our core business remains that of traditional book publishing, you know.
Of course.
And so we... We publish I work for Gian Giacomo Feltrinelli, which editore, which is the historic imprint of the Feltrinelli Group. But the group also contains IF, which publishes under the brands Gribaudo and Crocetti, SEM and Napogeo. We own a majority stake in the Venice-based publishing company Marsilio. We also own the Spanish publishing house based in Barcelona, Anagrama. Across these various publishing companies, we publish hundreds of new titles every year. Feltrinelli itself has an active catalogue of some 4,000 titles. And so the key core business for us remains that of acquiring book publication rights, publishing the books. But we are increasingly looking at acquiring all rights in all formats, and to be exploiting those rights either directly ourselves or by licensing them to other people. For example, we acquired the publishing house, Milan-based publishing house SEM, earlier this year, which is going to be relaunched in 2024. It's going to be focused on high-quality commercial publishing, crime fiction, fantasy, thrillers, things like that. Mm-hmm. And we are launching that. One of the key lines of the new SEM in 2024 is a new collana, as they say in Italian, a new publishing line called Italian Tabloid, which is going to be focused on true crime. And we have already agreements with a media partner for the production of podcasts, which will help us launch this line, and we have we're in the process of finalizing an agreement with a large Italian film production company, in which they will have a first look at all of the books that will, all of the stories that will be originated under this Italian Tabloid line, and I can see that stories from that the Italian Tabloid will become a sort of laboratory in which stories will be originated, and it won't necessarily be the case that they will be that they will appear first as books. Although, as I say, I underline, you know, our core business remains that.
Listening to you, I can rephrase my question. You are not living in a transmedia world. You are a media for the trans world.
Yes.
Let's say it like this. But it's interesting what you are saying just now about tabloids and so on. It's also IP properties. And we are lucky enough to have with us this afternoon the representative of another publishing house, and not just any publishing house, the Prisma Group, which is a subsidiary of Vivendi, occupies in France a central place in the world of magazine press. And I would like to introduce you, Philippe Schmidt, who holds multiple positions within this group, including that of executive director of Prisma Licenses. Thank you, Philippe, for being here today. But what can be the relationship between a magazine publisher and the audiovisual world?
Yes, thank you so much for having me today. Hello, everybody. So I think intellectual property, first and foremost, is one of the most fascinating and most important subjects we can talk about in our times. Why is that so? Because it has a tremendous impact on society as such, on businesses, how we do it, and maybe even also on our democracies. Let's phrase it this way. Labor and land in the agricultural age, which was machines and factories in the industrial age, we are still halfway out, by the way, is intellectual property in the informational entertainment age we are living and we're entering in. So I would argue that it's almost the new liquid gold of our new era. Why is that so? Liquid? Because where content and IP creates something new and fascinating and engaging, eyeballs and attention will flow to and will create data that flies from and hence will create a lot of value because people will be ready to pay for it. People will be ready to pay for it with monetary units, but even more importantly with their attention. And we all know the day only has 24 hours and the most important and precious thing we all have is time. So how can IP help to win the battle of attention? That is the most important question. And to talk about this, especially also in a legislative, new opportunity to structure and reshape our future in Europe, is absolutely strategic, also from a geopolitical point of view. Because we all know now data, information, is the new liquid gold that we can also like determine the importance of Europe in a bigger scheme of things. So perfect. But I thought it's very important to clear that out. And then, as mentioned, Prisma Media is a part of Vivendi. Vivendi is an international media group. The microphone is a bit shaky. With an European, purely European DNA and origin, but in a worldwide presence and ambition. There is a book publishing. Soon they will acquire Hachette, the third biggest book publisher in the world, after Penguin Random House and HarperCollins. Also, let me say, why is book publishing becoming so sexy in this informational entertainment era? There were a couple of years ago, everybody thought like printed books were out. It's like e-books and some even remember the mega flop fire of Amazon. Here we are, and companies are spending billions and billions for acquiring book publishing companies. Why is that so? Because the origin of the chain of IP is mostly coming from books. And we have like tons of examples. I'm a gamer, so everybody maybe remembers The Witcher, coming from an Eastern European author, a series that was a worldwide success in video gaming and now came to Netflix. There are tons of other examples. And within Vivendi, after the book, we have a gaming company, we have audiovisual pay TV player like Canal. Everybody knows the only European maybe competitor of the big American platforms, spending literally about 3 to 3.5 billion euros per year in investment in content. And then there's Prisma Media, so far a French player in the magazine and in the online world. And we are struggling in this new era to basically also defend our business model. And I thought it's interesting also today to talk about business models. Because, just give you one example, We were historically the number one magazine publishing house in France, about 20 different brands. The French speakers amongst you would know, like Geo, Capital, Sam Interess, Femme Actuelle, and so on, but also international licenses and brands like National Geographic, Harper's Bazaar, Harvard Business Review, and so on. And we did a pretty good job in the last 15 years to transform those brands into the online world and became, at least in France, in almost all categories, number one by reach, IP, brands, eyeballs. And in the online world, the business models are a bit more tricky, even though when you have reach, there are tons of brands that had like millions and billions of views on Facebook, and they still shut down a couple of years later. We all know those guys, Vice and others. And so it's hard to make a living out of the online world, even though you have like a tremendous reach. And in the French advertising market, because we mostly make money from those eyeballs and this tremendous reach we have in France through advertising, because paywall is a tricky thing, because like a French household only has so much budget to spend on Netflix, Prime, Spotify, and so on. There are 80% of the online digital advertising market in France, 80% are run by three players, right? So Meta, Alphabet, and Amazon. And basically the local players are fighting for the crumbs that are falling off the table of those mastodons. So it's super important by a legislative framework, and I'm looking also to our representative of the European Union, that like what has been done has been helping tremendously through the neighboring rights, maybe we talk about it later, through the Digital Market Act, to the Digital Services Act, and now generative AI. So it's the most fascinating topic of the time.
Brilliant. So we can close now the debate. No, we have another participant and somebody completely different. Just escaped from the immersive island. Here is Sven Haberlein, yes, from Trotskind. It may be hard to believe, but this young man already has 20-year career as a 3D artist, editor, screenwriter, and director. Passionate about interactivity, he once took ZDF spectators to the planet Mars. And now, back on Earth, he thinks VR is a great booster for storytelling. He has an idea every minute, and he said to me that he should be interested to make a VR game called Dr. Zhivago against the Gattopardo.
We can talk about it.
We have to discuss. So Sven, more seriously, can you tell us what relationship you have with this notion of IP, intellectual property?
At the end, IP is content, and it's not always, but often story-driven and character-driven. And I worked all my life with characters, starting with 3D animation and character animation, and later writing story, making short movies, mostly features, not so many documentaries. And then started to do interactive installations with Kinects. And then in 2014, I had my first VR experience. It was my second after the 90s, but my first from the new area. And I was thinking, okay, that is something completely new, and that will change the world, and that will change how we consume stories and how we consume content in an audiovisual way. And then I started to work with VR for a long time. We did everything you could imagine with it. And then we developed a couple of VR escape rooms. So we built our own location-based VR system. We developed our own IP with that, Huxley, that has two titles, the robot Huxley and the multiplayer escape rooms that you can play at locations. And then, for example, we were also looking into other IPs because, of course, sometimes you think it's a good idea to have a good name for that, and we talked with IP holders, and it was very difficult, and at the end we didn't make it. We made our own IP also for the second title and the third title, and now we are developing a game the VR game for the home market, and we are part of the gap financing market on the island. And it's very difficult still to finance immersive content because nobody is your other. The book market is out, the film market is out, and the game market is also out because you do VR, you don't do a game. And for me, that is not the question for the future. The future is very, 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 very short before people are not asking, do I want to watch a movie or play a game? And then choose one or the other platform and one or the other content. I believe in the future where people start maybe to watch something, then they say, now I want to play it inside. Then they get maybe a phone call, so they want to go back to the watching modus so they can have the phone call at the same time. And then they jump back into it very immersed. And that is a big, big topic for us because at the moment these are different industries, different people, different conferences. I'm coming just from the Gamescom last week, and it's a different life. And I think for the user, for the young audience, it's not different anymore. And they don't say, oh, this is a game. Okay, that should be a game until the end. It should be. So for me, transmedia doesn't mean I have one IP and I make a game out of it, I make a movie out of it or anything. I think in the future it will be one thing, I don't know how we will call it, which can be in different versions consumed. And for me it's the same as with web design, with responsive design. When the mobile phone was, or the smartphone was introduced, from the moment on, responsive design was the most important thing, that your website works on every device. And that will be, I think, the whole thing that we have now with Apple coming into the market. And of course, it's too expensive, the first version, but think in 5-6 years, then a lot of people will have this kind of devices that can be 2D flat screen or 3D immersive, can be interactive, non-interactive, and we need content for that, and it must be switchable, and that means that all the industries have to grow together, and people have to learn different skills, and it's not an easy task. As a game designer, I'm also a game designer, it's very, very, very difficult to design something that works so responsive in different environments. But the people don't ask, they will not ask, is it difficult or not? They will consume it. And then it's our work to create it. And you was talking a little bit about the political dimension. I think this is also very big because this kind of content is very, very expensive. Definitely. Because it's a game and a movie and that all together in one. So we talk about very expensive content, and this is where we go, we have a problem sometimes in Europe with expensive content when it comes to that big content. Big, big games like GTA, they're coming from not Europe. And for me, it's a really big question, how can we create this kind of world that you create in your book in an audiovisual format that is playable and non-playable, watchable, alone, with multiplayer, with other together, and everything all in once.
Wow, so. It's like, I just, it's so amazing, everything here. I mean, I just have like 55 ideas all the time. Sorry.
So, yeah, that's my thinking. And then, of course, the IP is very important because that's, if this is good, then can be a big, big thing. And if it's a bad IP, then if the story is bad, then also consumers going away. And we see it already in the cinema that IP is not always selling it. And there's a very famous thing in VR, for example. There was a location-based entertainment company, The Void, and they were together with Disney, and they had Star Wars. And you, I, at this time, I was saying, okay, they will be sold out every time, every day. That will be the big thing. And they open up, and yeah, also the IP didn't save them. So it's super cool, but also you need to make good content. And that's also for me this. And we have often questions when we pitch a game, then sometimes people ask, yeah, and what is this IP? And did you want also make a movie out of it and that and that and that? And then I always say, yeah, okay, let's first make one good product and then we have an IP and then we can start to think about all the other stuff. But first you need one good, like it's a proof of concept of the IP. You need this one product that is really good with this IP. And from there on, then you can build a whole world around it.
But you speak about Disney. If you look at the big success of Disney, it's European fairy tales, European IPs. And so the next question, but this is for everybody here, is do we have a chance one day to be strong enough in front of Asian IPs or American IPs? Maybe, David, you have a 10 years experience in China.
Yeah. Well, I think that what we have to realize is that we have in Europe something very unique that I think, like, as I said earlier, you know, what we do is we try to get, and, you know, I didn't say we are the four founders of this company, but in every project we develop, there are outside people coming in with outside expertise. So we are working kind of more like in clusters around different projects. It's not just us four who do everything, not at all. And we are not even working, all four of us, on every project. So I think that we have something very, very interesting here in Europe, which is that we have a huge amount of very talented people, but also a huge diversity of experience, of human experience, of cultural experience. And if we, you know, we had this discussion just now, like, why is suddenly IP a big thing? Why are we talking about this suddenly? And it has to do with the huge amount of content that, you know, us as eyeballs, I mean, if I put on my eyeball hat, us as eyeballs are tempted to watch and the attention that we need. So then suddenly, you know, of course, you need to give a little bit more to the spectator than just simply a TV series or simply this or simply that. You need to have something more. And I think that naturally we tend to go towards something that opens more than just one door, that opens something, a grander understanding of the human experience. And I think in Europe, because we have the diversity, the cultural diversity, we can offer a grander understanding of the human experience simply because we are so different. And I think that the key is, on the one hand, create new ways of working together, and I'm going to be pitching another thing, which is that with Dark Riviera, we just received a grant from the European Union in the framework of Writing European, and this is precisely what we are trying to do, is to develop new ways of working together across borders, and new ways of creating content that can travel and get international, that get international eyeballs, so to speak. So I think that it's really important to remember that we kind of already have, but we need more best practices, let's say. But we also need to make sure that, and I love China, but that the Chinese and the Americans don't buy everything when they become successful. And this is super important. And I'm not a businessman, and I'm, you know, maybe you can talk about this. But, you know, I think this is really, really important, that we need to keep control over what we create. As you just said, yeah, what is Disney without Grimm? You know, the Brothers Grimm, nothing. You know, and so I think that we should learn from that, and we should adapt to this new circumstance. And the last thing I would like to say in this case is, yes, it is difficult to create GTA, but we do create Assassin's Creed. You know, or you know, I mean, I'm not comparing, but there is possibilities. But also, I think that we need to open up to the idea that not everything has to be AAA. You know, there can be content where you can have a mid-budget TV series, an indie game, and a graphic novel, and it can become a very, very successful IP.
It doesn't have to be a Hollywood film that cost $400 million. And look at how Star Wars is tanking right now. Maybe we have done everything. Mm-hmm. And I think this is really important, is once again about what is it that makes IP. And I think that, and you were mentioning fan fiction. I think fan fiction is a super interesting thing. I think that studying fan fiction, I don't know if everyone knows what fan fiction is. Do you know what fan fiction is? Okay, so fan fiction is basically, let's say I watch a film, a really, really good Italian film, and I say, but what happened to the main character afterwards? And then you write it yourself. You write out, like, yeah, and the Giovanni afterwards got married with Julia, and then they had three kids, and he became a fisherman, and then he drowned, and then he's, you know. And you write a book, and you publish it. You put it online, and then people love it. And then they say, yeah, but Julia is not like this. I think Julia should. And this is fan fiction. It's just organically the IP is growing. And to understand, I think, on a very basic level, how to make IPs, read fan fiction. Really. It's super interesting. Because then you understand what is it that audiences of this kind of content in that country crave.
Yes.
If you want some time to applaud, you can. Okay.
To say with an indie game, it was super interesting at the Gamescom, at the indie area, how many visual novel games there were. And it's a big thing, and I went to them, to some of them, because I was thinking, okay, maybe a small two-man, three-man team. No, they were teams of 50 to 20 people working on this kind of game. That is a higher budget, and that they earn. So there is a big market, and it doesn't have to be AAA all the time. And we already talked a little bit, or there was already AI, and also technology is very, very interesting to make also European ready to it, to reduce the cost of production. Yeah? And it's not to copy something from something else, but the idea about, for example, 2D to 3D, yeah? Creating 3D models out of really nice 2D concept art is because the work it saves is very mechanical. It's like a factory. You have a concept art, you give it to the artist, and then they try to be exact as the concept. And I think there will be a lot of possibilities also for AI. And I think we need a lot of rules, but we also need to use the power to get rid of a lot, and especially film is very optimized in that way that at the film set, everyone is mostly used also in post-production, and not maybe, but then when it goes into post-production and 3D and CGI, then there are sometimes hundreds of people painting every picture, and it's not optimized anymore. And the same is with game development. There's so many jobs that are not creative, that are really repetitive, and I think that software can help, and that will also evolve into that smaller teams can create bigger audiovisual birds.
So, and gentlemen, I'm the moderator, and I can see that those two geeks are speaking a lot, but we want to have also the opinion of the two publishers. maybe I have a tricky question for you, because everybody here is okay to say that IP has a huge value, but what is the cost of an IP? What is the economic model around the IPs? You have to speak now.
Okay. So Homo sapiens' brain is cabled in a way that it only really gets steamed up when you hear an amazing story. That's the way we work, right? So how come that in the top 10 market caps of this planet, they're basically only American and some Chinese tech companies, and maybe one French luxury brand or group, right? they're not kings in tech. They're just selling bags and scarves and great dresses. How come their multiple for the market cap is sometimes 200 times the EBITDA? Let's talk some business, okay? So this is all equity of shared imagination. It's all immaterial. So value comes from how can you drive a bigger equity of shared imagination. What a genius George Lucas was when he said, don't pay me for the movie, but I want all the... Somebody's always like censoring me here.
You have to pass the mic.
I censor. So seriously, so if you take IP, there may be three... Yeah. Maybe three sequences you want to look at. The first one is the production. Then is how you create a tremendous engagement and audience, and then how you capture that value. And there should be legislative, technological, and rights questions to all those different parts. And I mean, who many of you are parents? If you have daughters, have you lived the frozen phase? Oh my God. I've heard like, you know, Libéré or, yeah, like... It's unbelievable. They go nuts. And Disney does such a good job. Everybody cites Disney. Vivendi wants to be European with Disney. How do they make it? Everybody says also, okay, the Americans, they do so well. Why do they do well? Because it's also the country with the most mixed cultures in one huge, tremendous market. We have this in Europe, but we cannot leverage it. How come that when an American story works in the US, it works all over the world? Because you have the biggest mix of diversity, religions, skin types, and so ever. So we have a panel here of five white male European men. Great job. At least we're from different countries. So we have so much to learn and to make headway on this. Because when a story is not appealing to everybody, well, guess what? It will not please everybody. And then you cannot capture that value.
We were introduced by a woman, though.
Yes, it's true. It's true. It's true. No, but seriously, it's an important thing to know, right? And oh, we have like a comment here. It's okay, it's a snap. So have this in mind, right? So equity of shared imagination. How can that be created? And then how can it be protected, obviously? Because somebody had maybe the big, great beginning, but then it was slipped away and somebody took it and made it better. And fan fiction is exactly that. Why does everybody love Lord of the Rings? And why do they get such a hard time when they don't use Peter Jackson for the next one? Or The Witcher when they fire the main actor and nobody's happy. So the fans have like such a big part now of the equity. If the designers, the creators, if they mess up, the fans will punish you. Oh boy. And then there's no business anymore. So this is super interesting, I think, to take this into account. And then we have, like, obviously, maybe coming later to that, so the new creative paradigm of generative AI. Because I mentioned the industrial age. So it was the robotics era as a disruptor for, let's say, blue colors. Is AI for white colors? So let's say at Vivendi, we have Avast Group, one of the biggest communication companies in the world. If you can ask ChatGPT tomorrow, okay, give me 15 ideas of the next Burger King spot. It should appeal to families, it should be funny, it should be diverse, and it should be like playing like maybe in a restaurant or not. And he gives you 15 ideas, and two of them are not so shabby. And then you go in the funnel and say, those two, now let's go deeper, and so on and so on. And that's why the new jobs of the future, like prompt writers, they can make up to $200,000-$300,000 a year. If you brief that thing well, yes, sometimes they come up with good answers. It's not great yet, and we talked about it in the preparation, but it will get great very, very fast. But then again, diversity, because who programmed ChatGPT? White, male, Anglo-Saxon, WASPs, and so on and so on. So we have all this like different chunks of the sequences, and we have to work on all of them. And then just to close the loop, Europe. Europe is the United Nations of cultures, of states, of languages. So yes, there are boundaries and there are like difficulties because we don't all speak the same language. We have to go back to English even to make a European like, you know, panel. But again, there's like tremendous potential. We have to leverage with like a framework, with the technology, with the European champions we have to create and work together across boundaries and borders.
I think that Lawrence should be happy that you present yourself to the election too. It's next June. Theo?
Well, as an English person working in Europe, I'm often asked about competing with America, English language audiences, or Anglo-Saxon audiences, as the Italians call it. I don't know. I feel that, you know, maybe I don't have the expertise of some of the other panelists on the on this, but I can offer a gut instinct, which is yes, of course, you know, at the level of creativity, absolutely, Europe can compete with the rest of the world, and we, I mean, we see in the world of publishing, which is, you know, my world, we see frequently fantastic projects that, that conquer the world, Steve Glass and Elena Ferrante, or whatever, the many, many, many projects that come out of Europe, which can stretch across the world. We've seen TV series as well. Feltrinelli author Roberto Staviano, for example, Gomorra was a hit across the world. What does it cost? That was the question. What is it?
It was a question.
Yeah. I mean, that's a tricky one, really. I mean, in my world, you know, it's like asking how long is a piece of string. You know, one thing that I would say about the world of publishing, though, is that enshrined in the business model is the notion that if you sell more copies as an author, as a creator, then you receive more royalties, you know, and the idea that that a greater economic success is in some way devolved back to the creator of the IP, if we want to use that word, the writer of the book, if we want to say that instead, is a key concept, a key aspect of diritto d'autore, as they say in Italian, of the way publishing contracts for copyright are formulated. And it seems to me that that is ever so slightly under threat in the world of audiovisual adaptations, and that that seems to me a concept that that needs to be protected, basically.
But, to be again it's very concrete, Sven said a moment ago that he wants some time to buy IPs in order to give market value to the games or to the VR program, and he can't. And so, is it possible that an IP will be shared with a creator in a kind of co-production system? You know, I'm coming back on the economic model, because it's a pity to see David and their friends, they create an IP factory in order not to buy the IP of others. But in the same time, there is so much IPs in the hands of Philippe and of Theo. How can we do to manage this contradiction?
Well, I think part of what we do as a publishing house is protect authors' rights, you know, and I would be delighted to sit down with Sven and talk about a Gattopardo, Dr. Zhivago mashup. But a key point in the back of my head at the beginning of such a discussion would be what would the author's heirs think about this project, you know? And there is no preset answer to that, honestly. Honestly, there isn't. You know, you may have an author who's very open-minded, who would be really interested in sitting down, or another one who would be equally open-minded but would be prepared to say, do what you want, you know. However, for anyone handling rights in a position like mine, you you need to have in you know, and we're in the business of publishing author-driven content, you know, for want of a better phrase, you know. And you have to have in mind your relationship with the author, and it may well be in the case of book publishing that the author sees their creation as appropriate for publication as a book and little else, you know.
I would like to add that also, like in this new world, informational entertainment world, that the aggregator creates more value than the creator. Let's take the example of the European Union helped a lot with the neighboring rights in the online world. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the subject. So basically, what makes the most money for Google? The search, right? So how does the search work? The search helps you to find relevant content in an ocean of infinite information. So there's a joke, there's no better place to hide a body than the second page of Google, right? Everybody only watches the first page of Google, ever. So if you make it on there, great, great job. And Google rates those contents so they make it to the first page. So if a publisher or relevant content make it to that first page, that's great. And Google creates those eyeballs as an aggregator and then makes money out of it from AdWords and their programmatic advertising business. But those aggregations only make sense if you have content to rank, right? And there's obviously a lot of user-generated content, but also very high-quality journalistic content. Otherwise, nobody would go on Google anymore because there's no great content. So for about 15, 20 years, the company created $1 billion market cap on referencing other people's content. And only in Europe, people were bold enough to impose the neighboring rights, where Google was really forced to come to table and negotiate with publishers all over Europe to recompensate of that value they create through the search engine with those publishers. And we negotiated about 2 years to get that contract signed. And it needed like heavy, heavy, heavy fines from the European Commission to get them really like pay and make it happen. And so there's still platforms, I want to address them also, like they're still under this legislation and they still not even come to the table and talk to negotiations, like ex-Twitter and others, because what would they do without like quality content? So there is a big role and responsibility of the legislators, especially in Europe, to create that framework, because otherwise local, national, or transnational European origin players cannot win in this battle of giants and titans. It's really important to know that the aggregator like gets the biggest chunk, and it's really important to protect the IP creators, because even if they claim, and it's hard. And now comes the generative AI engines. And a week ago were the first 15 French publishers who closed down their websites so they cannot be crawled anymore by ChatGPT and its cousins. Because ChatGPT, again, ChatGPT, I don't know who you're familiar with, what this GPT means. It's generative pre-trained transformer. So it means they are already smart because they were pre-trained and transformed by all the content you give them and what they read online in the open web. So okay, Wikipedia is a big chunk for sure, but if you don't want to fake news and only some weirdo content, you need actually like auto journalists and serious IP creators to make ChatGPT smart. And ChatGPT made Microsoft and Bing and very, very, very powerful now, and the creators invited to all different round panels, round tables, and even Google is trembling, and they create $1 billion market caps, and the media, the content creators and other, they are not seeing any chunks. So how can we get that value back? We can close shop and say, you can't read my content anymore. Yeah, but there's still others who give it to them for free. So there need also be like a framework from the European Commission to help us to get that value back. And it's a black box, because the open web, at least you can see your web pages, you can see what Google chose to get up there. But in the ChatGPT, it's a black box. You don't see how it answered and which content was used. And there might be like also some new technological challenges to make that happen. I'm not a tech, but I think about the blockchain. What if ChatGPT read a chunk that made it smarter in one field, get a little watermark, and it travels like with the content that is used, so you know when ChatGPT gives X, Y, Z million answers every day that you have like 0.0001% of that value creation, and then you get a check, and then you actually also can recreate great content and make it better and smarter. And fake content and illicit content is one has the bonus, one has the malice. So I don't know how many of you followed the Digital Services Act that just came out end of August. That is a breakthrough of Europe to basically constrain the gatekeepers, the 16 big tech companies who get all the value, and basically make them responsible for illicit and fake content, and that content will drown great content. And then people have not enough trust anymore, and we have like problems with our democracies. So the problem is so big that we need to work hand in hand over countries, with the European Commission, with the creators, and through companies also, and get the funding, because we cannot just ask for money that cannot be earned. We have to make that money and give like a tremendous potential to that business models that can survive, because otherwise we'll be only reading like fake news and IPs which are not like even having anything to do anymore with Europe, and our kids will grow up with stories who have nothing to do anymore with our cultural background. So it's an urgent subject.
I want to ask to a natural intelligence, not artificial, to David GPT Duza.
That's me.
What is your feeling about what Philip said?
Yeah, I mean, for me, my biggest fear when it comes to artificial intelligence or ChatGPT or whatever is how it can empower cybercrime, for example. How easy it is to pretend to be someone else when you can generate the voice. I mean, now it's like, it's not anymore the Nigerian prince email. It's going to be super convincing, written in your mother's, tone. I mean, so that is really scary to me. And when it comes to disinformation, obviously, I mean, and we are just seeing the beginning of generated video content. I mean, how will we know what is real? And, if I see the president of France running around naked in the street, okay, yeah, I know it's fake. But what if it's just a few words different? What if it's just a little bit different? How will I know? So for me, my fear as a citizen of Europe, that is my biggest fear, especially in a time of polarization, the rejection of science and in those terms, that's what scares me. I would like just to add something about America and Europe. So I think the big difference between America and Europe is obviously that there is national players in America. So they have a huge market, but there's also Fox, and there is like HBO, and there is Netflix. While here we have so many different TV channels, so like if we want to do something really big, there are few players. There are some, Studio Canal, but there are few players who can carry that kind of those kind of projects. And if we want to get together too many TV channels, there are no TV channels here, right? Too many cooks. Sometimes it becomes the Euro soup. So we have to be very careful about that, which leads me into what the AI can be good and creating cheaper special effects, for example, creating cheaper CGI. So my biggest dream, right, because I'm a big science fiction fan, I would love to do science fiction TV series, but I don't have $400 million. So my biggest dream is that, the AI technology will have the same impact on CGI and special effects, just like the video, the mini DV camera had for documentaries. It made possible, like, what's the name? Blair Witch Project. Blair Witch Project it's a great example, like a horror film, low budget, super successful, only possible because there is digital filmmaking. So I'm really hoping that this technology will allow me as a European with not $400 million, but maybe just 40, to make Star Wars. I mean, the same type of, the stuff that we really, I love, I cannot, and because that will create diversity. There will not just be Star Wars. There will be like a million different other kinds of fantasy, science fiction. I mean, I really read like 30 science fiction books a year. And I'm thinking, oh, fuck, I really want to do this. No, forget it. Can you imagine me pitching this to TF1? No, forget it. I'm not even trying. Maybe a graphic novel. And that's my. And now I'm hoping that, with this technology, maybe I'll say, yeah, but why not? We can do this.
Fine.
Yes, so it's boosting creativity in audiences. And
Sorry, say it again.
lot to lose as well.
I don't think we heard the whole your whole.
Sorry. Maybe because I'm a woman, but what you're speaking is incredibly interesting and enlightening. But I do think that we must remember that a lot of people in this room are the people that actually create the IP, and they want to know how to protect their IP or keep it. And it's a different perspective to what was spoken, but. Regarding all the AI, it may enable you to make the next Star Wars, but sorry, I'd live without it if I knew that so much other stuff is safer. And I think that to discuss AI, it's a huge additional panel perhaps, but I see a lot of red lights in the horizon with AI.
Absolutely, and this is why we need legislation. I mean, for me, AI is super weird because we had this discussion in an AI panel like an hour ago. But the problem with AI is it's not a tool; it's a black box. We don't know what the algorithm, what it's programmed, what's prioritized, what's not prioritized, how it decides, and so on. So yes, it's a black box. But I have yet to see. An invention, well, however horrible it is, that could be ignored or could be, like, say, oh, this is too dangerous. It has never happened. So the only thing we can do is legislate to make sure that is not abused. I mean, I don't see like the nuclear bomb. I mean, it was invented, it's horrible, and now we just have to live with it in a way. It's part of who we are, unfortunately, I think. We invent horrible stuff.
Destructive,
yes.
You mean?
Yes, we do. I cannot say against. That's who we are. Wonderful and horrible.
On the question of the protection of the IPs, I must say that we decide before this panel not to go into the legal side of things because we are not specialists enough. and because there is no unanimity in... even in the European Commission about this. It's a work in progress, and so we do prefer to speak today with you about what is an IP, what is the value of an IP, what is the marketing power of an IP, and so on. So with those four white guys... on the panel, thank you, Theo. Not having a bird, you are the diversity guarantee. Maybe everybody.
It's great. I shaved this morning.
Maybe everybody has a little word of conclusion because I will ask to Martin to make the big conclusion. But let's have a last round.
Because you were talking about protecting IP, I think the best way to protect your IP is to make content with your IP, because then it's already there. I think we had it with Berserk Rims. I don't think Disney would use it if there would be so many cool content from Europe. But it was story, it was lying there. And I think to create something from your IP is always protecting it in a way. And I think that is what can boost in the future. And I think that is very important that we are able and enable to create more and more and use our IP and not sell it then to China or America.
Yeah, and maybe so to build on that, I would say, and the one way of doing that is to give a meaningful upside to the creators. And a meaningful upside is obviously money, but not just. You know, it's also about being able to participate in the growth, like artistic growth, not financial, artistic growth of one's IP, a meaningful upside. And a meaningful upside can be, yeah, I'm the creator of this show. Yes, I should be able to get involved in the casting. Yes, but not just like saying like, okay, this this gaming company, they make games, but not the kind of games that this should be. You know, like that kind. And, you know, of course, if it's not, I mean, if you're lucky, you can have a nice, you know, publisher or producer or whatever who will let you. But it's, you're in the graces of the people who own the IP. You're not, so what we are trying to do at Dark Riviera is also to find new legal, new types of contracts, new types of, you know, relationships with the authors that we work with that gives them some kind of a meaningful upside, artistically and also financially.
Philippe, a last word before your campaign for the election.
Yeah, so I mostly talked about business today, so I want to say something about more like the society and the artwork behind IP. I think great IP can change the way we see the world better than any argumentation. And I have a great example you just gave me through the discussion with, like, you had with David. Because why did Christopher Nolan do the movie Oppenheimer right now? Maybe it's Ukraine, but actually he said a couple of times behind closed doors it's because of ChatGPT. Okay, so you cannot stop progress. Okay, you can just give it the right, maybe, traction in the right direction. So you have become a little bit more fantastic than horrific, because the nuclear power is there. It helps us in France to pay low energy bills. But you have also the problem with, like, the bomb. And ChatGPT will be the same thing. Progress cannot be stopped. It has to be, like, mastered, right? And another good example is climate change. It's, like, a huge topic. After the summer, there's still some people contesting it. There was never, ever an IP who did a better job to understand how stupid we are than the movie Don't Look Up. Because obviously it was not about the planet, the asteroid coming down on us. It was how stupid we are not to see the obvious while we are getting soon fried. So IP can change the way we live, the way we see society, we see what happens to us. So there's a tremendous responsibility and power in IP creators like you. So keep on writing. Thanks.
Theo Zhivago, you have the last name.
Well, within the Feltrinelli Group, we are obviously concerned with the business of publishing high-quality, author-driven content, rewarding authors accordingly, both financially and creatively. And that would lead to stories or books being adapted into different formats. I think that's a great thing, as long as the level of quality is maintained, be that a podcast or a film adaptation, TV series, theatrical adaptation or whatever. I think, I come from a slightly more traditional background, and the contractual models, I think, are sufficient at the moment for these things. The world of AI is not really reached publishers such as ourselves yet, except actually with the question of audio books. We've had people come to us and say, "Why don't you have your audio book read by this actor? You can use a little bit of that voice with a little bit of this voice." And But otherwise, yes. I mean, I think we're interested in publishing high quality content and in as many different diverse formats as make sense for that particular book. Yeah.
Thank you. So it's time for conclusion, and as I am sorry to call for another man on the stage, I just want to thank Sarah Brunet about the wonderful way she prepared all this. So, there was a girl in the organization. And so, now I have to call Martin Dawson. He is such an important man in the DG Connect that I have to read my notes in order to say his exact job description. So let's welcome the Deputy Head of Unit on Audiovisual Industry and Media Support Programs. Yes, I did it. Martin.
Philippe. Philippe, after such an introduction, I have to live up to. But this is more about you, about the panelists, about the panel, and the audience. I think there was a great response, great interest, and I have to say it was one of the more refreshing and fun panels for a while. I think you showed that we are living in very interesting times, times of great change, and we thought it was natural to do this in Venice, Venice Film Festival, because not only because of the Biennale, as we see traditionally interested in the relationships between different forms, art forms, but also they've taken the lead a few years ago now to put VR on the map, to have a competition for virtual reality and recognise it as an art form in itself. And I think we made a good choice. We did not want to focus on the legal aspects. We know there's a ongoing, constant, permanent discussion about legal aspects of IP. And in a sense, it was because of that that we wanted to come at it from the other angle. You know, why is IP so important? You know, and it's not just the legal aspects. It's not just the money aspects. I think what we did succeed in talking about was creativity and audiences. So I cannot try and summarise everything that was said because it was very rich. But a few things that particularly struck me were this notion that we have to be more ambitious in terms of the experiences, the more fundamental, wider human experience that we can try and tap into. So not just a film or a book or a TV series, which are quite compartmentalized, but something else which transcends all of that, perhaps. And there are more and more opportunities. So transmedia IP is not a new idea. I think it was discussed 10 years ago, 20 years ago. But it's somehow accelerating and growing because of technology. It wasn't mentioned, but I think it's underlying, of course, that we had 3G, 4G, 5G. We will have 6G. We'll have more and more fiber. We'll have the Internet of Things. As this connectivity infrastructure becomes more powerful, it will enable a lot more content to be produced and distributed than ever, more and more digitally as well. And the aspect of audiences in an attention economy, as was said, to stand out, to be visible, to grab the attention, producers, artists are looking for new angles, and the transmedia angle can give you that. I liked very much this vision we heard about of everything all at once. Everything all at once. It sounds a bit much, but I guess that's the idea. And then we talked about if those were, in a sense, the opportunities, visions for the future, what could be done. We talked a bit about the enabling factors, you know, how to do it, how to enable it. I'd like to make the next Star Wars, but I don't have $400 million, you know? So we heard that, in fact, AI can be, if controlled, something that can boost creativity, enhance human creativity by doing the boring stuff, by doing the repetitive stuff, by being a tool which can turbocharge your imagination, in fact, by freeing up your imagination and helping small teams build big worlds. That was a phrase I wrote down. And investment. So investment is always part of the picture, that if you want to build everything all at once, perhaps every now and again it will break and it will not work. So it's a risky business. When it works, it could be a fantastic success. But perhaps as you're experimenting, nine out of 10 times it will not work. So who's going to invest in that? So you need some people. They tend to be risk capitalists, risk capital. And we need to think about how to channel that kind of investment. It certainly goes beyond traditional public funding models. But the stakes are high. We heard about the importance to retain European autonomy, European cultural independence. We are in a very competitive world. US was mentioned, China was mentioned, and they are mobilizing resources. There's the US model, there's the Chinese model. What is the EU model? What is the European model? Well, of course, we have our wonderful, beautiful European mosaic. We don't have the solution to all those things today, but certainly lots of food for thought. And that will feed into the work that you're all doing, hopefully, and certainly the work that we are doing through Creative Europe, the European Union program dedicated to the cultural sectors, including audiovisual. Audiovisual in the wide sense, film, cinema, TV series, but beyond. And we also have Media Invest, which is an equity investment tool, which is open for business. We look forward to signing the first deal at the San Sebastian Film Festival at the end of the month. And that is an equity investment platform dedicated to audiovisual in the wide sense. So I just underline that. And of course, it was not the subject, but it came up nonetheless. The regulatory framework, the policy framework, and the need to control technology, master technology, is certainly the principle that is driving the negotiations that are ongoing in Brussels between the EU institutions on the new law on artificial intelligence. Well, thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Fred Film Radio, 24/7 on Fred.fm and smartphone apps.